Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the second day of the LAC. I hope you had fun with the concerts yesterday, and lots of fun today as well. Sorry for the small delay here. We're going to start now with the first presentation of the day with Gianfranco Seacolini. You might know him from Mod Devices. He's the keynote speaker of this LAC. And the title of his talk is Mod, Building a Sustainable Linux Audio-Based Business.
Hello, everyone. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here on this beautiful Saturday morning in Berlin. I know it's better to be outside, but for me, it's a very big honor to be here today. We've been following the LAC for some time, and I admire lots of people from this community, so it's a big honor to be here. Thank you so much for hosting me. And presentation of today, I will do it in three parts. I'll talk about a bit about our history. I want to give you some insights, maybe some inspiration even, and tell you a bit about the big problems that we go through this history. Then I'll do a bit of an analysis of what happened until now. And then we talk a bit about the future and what we envision for the next years. And well, start with some history. I started playing the guitar and using a computer in 89, 90. Got my first guitar, a computer, a PC, the 286 using DOS, for those who remember. I had a PC speaker in my first computer. I've always been into effects and pedals, so as soon as I got a guitar, I got really hooked up on pedals and effects. And by 93, 95, I was switching to digital multi-effects, namely the A5 from Korg. I used it a long time, fiddled with the RP1 from Digitech. For those who remember those devices, they seemed very practical, but they were a pain in the ass in lots of senses, and the sound was not really good. And I also, at one point, got a new computer with a multimedia kit and started fiddling with sound, with the Sound Blaster, that famous sound card. 95, I got into university, and I'm a mechanical engineer, studied mechanical engineering, but on the sides, I've always been working with the system administration, basically being the IT guy. Assembled, I don't know, almost 100 computers through these years for the students' union, for people, for parallel works. And in terms of Linux, in university, on 97, on 98, I had my first contact. It was a Red Hat CD that I got from someone. Installed it, but I didn't got hooked up to it. For me, it was too difficult to what I expect for a computer. In 2000, I did this sabbatic year. I came out of university, and I went to work as a trafficker for DoubleClick. It was part of the dot-com bubble. And also, I worked in a home broker of Bovespa, is the stock exchange from São Paulo. I helped to do the home broker. These were very two interesting experiences. First of all, because of DoubleClick and this dot-com thingy that happened in the 2000. And the home broker, because to understand how the companies and the stock exchange work, they were very important later for the project. 2002, still in university, we had this guy, Marcelo Tosati. He became the kernel maintainer for kernel 2.4, and this was a Brazilian guy. And I'm from Brazil, by the way. And when this guy, when this happened, it gave all this impulse of Linux in the universities. And I made my second attempt. I used it Conectiva, which was a Brazilian distribution, Debian, Slackware, and those LAMP installations, the Linux, Apache. Like it a lot for servers, really interesting, but still not my cup of tea for actually a desktop computer. And one thing that I started doing a lot at these times was to get this idea of remote administration. I had a broadband connections that I would hack into to turn them into routers for distributing internet. By 2003, in my later years in university, I was already thinking on a programmable pedal. After using all these multi-effects, the question that was always there was like, why can't I deploy the software myself? Not meaning that I can do the code, but I knew people that could. I could do the machine at least. And I used a bit of Pro Tools in some studios, and I was really interested on their hardware and the DSP that was happening on the hardware that was not happening on the PC. I finished in university, moved to London, and on that move, I wanted to go more mobile, move it to the desktop, from the desktop to the notebook format. totally abandoned Linux at this time. I couldn't have Linux running on the laptop. And I fiddled a bit with being actually sysadmin on Windows. I did the test for the MCP. I can make a bit of silence now if you want to laugh about it. And not a good idea. Meanwhile, while that was happening, we had a president elected in Brazil, Lula. And when Lula came in 2003, he elected this guy, Gilberto Gil. He's a very famous Brazilian musician, as a minister of culture. And Gilberto Gil, he started a program called the Culture Spots, Pontos de Cultura. And it was this program to foster creativity, like artists, without like a popular program, not for not spending money and having resources. And in terms of music, Linux was really important. And they kicked off this program called Studio Livre. It was a website with all the information that was necessary. 2006, guys, remember how it was difficult to get a real-time system working. And they have a website in Portuguese with all the information necessary. It was quite an undertaking. It was translated to many languages. And in this particular program, two guys, Leo Germani and Asa, whom I didn't know at the time, they participated doing the Studio Livre. 2003, Arduino was born in Italy, the project. And sometime on this year, Jack was being developed. I don't know exactly but the dates, but I know that it was conceived at the LACs and developed and talked about on the main hall courses. So that was happening while I was in London. Went back to Brazil 2005, started working in Petrobras as the oil company. And at this point, I switched to Mac. I was using Windows until there, and I switched to the Mac. Was using a PowerPC MacBook. And 2007, I settled in Rio, and I said, okay, I'm going to assemble a box again, like a desktop for my home. And at that point, I said, I'll go to Linux again. I do another attempt. And it's when I got to Ubuntu. And I got totally hooked up. I was so impressed on the ease of use. I immediately got the Ubuntu Studio, and I was so impressed with the amount of tools and how easy it was to use. Jack, Latspa, JackRack, all these tools there. And at that point, Studio Livre was really important, was my channel to get to these tools. And in parallel, not related to audio, but very important to what we do today, was the Webmin, because I was still doing a bit of sysadmin works for in parallel. And Webmin was this web interface in which you could control another machine, so I wouldn't need actually to SSH into and go into console, but actually having a web page for that. It's quite obvious, but at the time it clicked my mind. And at this point I became a strong Linux advocate. With the USB sticks, I would just impregnate everybody's computer. I was actually a pain in the ass because I was, oh, did you see it? It's so cool, it's so nice, it's so easy. And 2008, still in Petrobras, I was very unhappy with my work there. And I started my first real moves on that idea of the pedal that I had some years before. I knew this guy from university, Kasha, just a nickname. And he had this company called Anguera. And another friend of his called Moreno, who already had worked with Sino Processing in a Brazilian pedal company. And we did our first ever move. We bought Analog Devices DSP chip, a development kit with the Shark processor, and tried some things and validated, okay, this is possible, there is a bit of code available and the hardware can do it, we can load new effects. The amount of work was staggering because we had to develop everything, but it was kind of, at least it was possible. At the same time, 2008, BeagleBoard was released, the first ever version. It was a joint venture of Texas, DigiKey, and Element 14. 2009, I started an actual partnership with Anguera, not only Kasha, but his company, and we applied for this public funding called Prime. Prime is for Primeira Empresa, first company. And we got $60,000 to spend in 1 year in the project that was approved. We moved it to another processor called Blackfin, also from Analog Devices, but still a DSP. And by July 2010, we had our first prototype. This box, that Blackfin inside. It had a micro Linux, not an actual Linux, with a port that we did of AUSA. We hired a person to do the port for us. He was And it was a very, very rough and conceptual prototype, but I already had the basic idea. I could plug the guitar in it, had only two effects, adjust some things. With that, we did some market research. We did some focus groups. And in July, we did the main one. And after the focus group, we got that, okay, it's very interesting, but this having to do everything, it's not possible. We really cannot pull this off. And so this was our first big pivot. We changed directions a lot. At this point, Crudo, who's here, joined the project with me. And he was working at Anguera at the point, but actually joined the project itself. And we moved a lot the direction, which is instead of going firmware DSP, we said we will embed an actual PC. At this point, mini ITX, the 17 time, per 17 boards were coming in the market. I remember this this cousin of Ubuntu called Puredyne, which was already tuned to multimedia, USB, the solid rock, real-time 2.6 kernel. There was also in the mix a hardware coming out. It was this portable studio. I was using a lot of LADSPA plugins, mainly CAPS, CALF, and Invada, and in my mind, that would already be a sort of a collection that would justify some sort of basic package that people could use. And I really lusted at this time for Guitarix and Rakarak, although they were not plugins at the time. Guitarix later on started releasing LADSPA plugins. After 1.5 years, in Christmas 2011, we had what they call the 10 pilots. I'll explain why the quotes. The idea was we developed a lot, the concept, and we built these pilots that we would hand to musicians and to friends to collect feedback and understand what would be the best way to actually do the product. And these pilots, they were Slackware-based. Impressively enough, I was the one doing the Linux OS. Today I look at it, I almost laugh. It has had the RT kernel. It had about 100 LADSPA plugins, a USB serial interface with the computer, so it was all serial, and a Python Qt GUI, basically squares, Bezier curves to connect. All the backend was developed by Crudo. I did the OS. We hired a guy to do the front end in Python. And the audio interface, we used the built-in audio interface. We just did analog analog adaptation to the so that you wouldn't use the small jacks and would have some adjustments. At the same year, October, they were releasing BeagleBone, which was the CAPE-enabled version of the BeagleBoard. Here's some pictures of the things inside. So you see mini ITX board. It had a compact flash card as a hard drive, power supply there, controller and audio interface. The reason of the quotes is that we did these units and the failure points were so many that I think only three of them actually worked. This is our office in a huge mess. And so we manufactured everything, all the connections, etc. We got the power, the motherboards, and we used the blower to remove the big jacks out of the back panel. It was really dirty. And but we had it, and at least one was really working well. And by the beginning of 2012, I was with one of these prototypes hunting for an interface developer. Those pilots, they worked really well. It could be very buggy to assemble the pedal boards, but once you did it, you actually could use it. The offer of plugins was good. And I made some decisions at this point. One of them was since we are using Linux and network, it's so straightforward, we are going to a network abstraction and leave the serial connection behind. In order to be able to use devices and not only the computer, we use it Bluetooth because it was supported by tablets, by phones, by computers. And in April with this prototype, I was hunting for this interface provider, and I went to my university and I found a company that was emerged from university as well, called HackLab. And they are open source based. They were one of the official maintainers of WordPress in Brazil. And those two guys from Studio Livre, Az and Leo, they were the founders of HackLab. I only found that later, and it was a very interesting coincidence. And
what HackLab did was to do the web GUI that we have today, this seamless integration between the device, the computer, and the cloud, and we move it at this point from LADSPA to LV2. February this year, Raspberry Pi was released. It's a British project, I believe, from the Raspberry Pi Foundation, using the Broadcom CPU. So after HackLab joined the project, we really connected. We started developing what would be the Mod Quadra. We got a lot of feedback from the pilots. And we disassembled the pilots. We assembled what we call the arcades. So it's still the hardware of the pilots, but we could fiddle on the back. This is the prototype that I, in April 2013, was presented at LAC in Graz. It was Leo and Bruno Gola. It was exactly that cabinet there, but with the system inside. And by September 2013, we were releasing the Quadra in the Brazilian market. It was already a very complete product on the sense that we had everything. It had the cloud, it had the beautiful interface, it had all the inputs. It was a very complete product, but it was a flop, commercially speaking. We assembled everything ourselves, mostly. We did 25 units of the Quadra. We did a launch in the kind of the Brazilian music messe, but lots of problems appeared. First of all, we were in Brazil. Imports and taxes, etc., make the price of production. It's impossible to compete. Our part list to do the Quadra was around $700. Only the parts list, already taken to Brazil and taxes. So. No way. We sold the Quadra for around $1,000, which is almost no profit for such a parts list price. And even then, no, it didn't. It doesn't go. Another very serious problem of the Quadra was that although it had all the functionality that we wanted, the audio was not to the point that you expect from a processing device. And first lesson learned. Doesn't matter how many cool features you have, if the important thing doesn't go, sorry, there's no way. There's really no way. People won't buy it. And in terms of interface, our software, just what happened here from in HackLab, this is what we started doing in late 2012, already a web GUI, but it's still kind of a vertical approach. We move it to a landscape approach in the middle of the way, did the plugin bar, had better interfaces by 2013. Just before Kickstarter, we had some very beautiful interfaces. It was very eye-catching already, what we were doing. 2014, second pivot. So we move abroad because Brazil is not going to be possible here. And mass production. Using the shelf components increases the price a lot. You cannot make use of economy of scale. Because then, as you increase the quantities, the price doesn't go up bad, doesn't go down that much. And things that happened in this year, first of all, in April we were at the LAC again. I did a presentation and premiered our video of the Quadra. In August, our Ale Cunha, also my co-founder, just like Rudo, joined the project first as an investor and then became an actual team member. And in October, we had the Kickstarter of the Mod Duo, the crowdfunding campaign. Very nice experience. We raised $83,000. We sold around 180-something units. Important things here about the campaign is that you never know what's coming out of a campaign. So we did the pivot that we say, okay, we are going to move out of Brazil. We had this project. But no one knows what's coming out of it up to the point that you finish the campaign. This is quite stressful, and in terms of a team, this uncertainty really brings the team down. It's a very cool thing, the Kickstarter, but not knowing what's going to happen, it's something to take into account. We finished the Kickstarter, funded, okay, now we have a big liability. We owe 200 mods and we don't have them yet. So we move it to Berlin. First idea was to go to the US, but US for visas, costs, many different factors, we opted not to go to the US and come to Berlin. We have it, European citizenships, which would make very easy, the visa issue would not be an issue actually. Berlin is, Germany is a very good country for manufacturing. Cost of living is okay, so we decided to come here. And that's, of course, personal reasons. Berlin is awesome, and the musical scene is here is very good. At this point, Falk joined our team. Harry had given me the hint to connect to Falk. We imported Falk from Portugal. We went to the LAC in Mainz, that huge team there, last time that we had a team so big. And in Sonar Plus D in June of that year, I had my first serious contact with investors. We did a bit of that in Brazil, but there's not an investment company, investment culture in Brazil. And so in Sonar, I had my very first real approach with investors and this thing about convincing someone to give you money to develop something. By February, I will skip some things about 2015. What I can say is, such a hard year. We thought we were going bankrupt. I don't know, I think about 10 times I thought, okay guys, let's close the door. At one point the company was me, Felipe, Crudo, and Ale, and that's it. but we managed to do it, and by February 2016, we were shipping the first Modulo units. Those were like very starting units. We did from the 200 duos that we had to ship, we parsed the users on users that would be willing to actually open the device if necessary, then users that would be willing to SSH into the device, and users that only wanted to do graphical interfaces. And we started shipping to those users that would be willing actually to open the device. The mod would break a lot at that time, and it would have actually to put a SD card and redo the deploy. By August, we were releasing version 1.0, the stable software, and but still a Kickstarter version, on the sense that we developed it a lot after Kickstarter, especially in terms of hardware, not only putting features. And 2017, Mod Devices GmbH was born. That's our company. Up to that point, we started in Brazil. We thought we were going to the US. Then we came to Berlin, so we had companies everywhere. IPs and contracts everywhere. It was a real mess. In terms of investment, this is a no-go. So making the consolidating everything into a German entity was a very important move for us. Second, certifications. Doing software, we don't have this concern, but doing hardware, you have to certify them. There are lots of regulations to do a hardware, and it's not easy. Mod Device GmbH was an important factor here because you need to be responsible, so you need an entity to be responsible. 2017, Max MSP integration was released. I will talk a bit later about it, but they came to us. We had already an intern called Nino. He was a Max MSP programmer. At this point, Felipe had some software from the distro, I believe, and they matched information, say, oh, we can have these Max MSP gen-based patches on the Duo, and we did that in an impromptu way. That information got to the Max MSP employees, and they came to us and said, oh, we are interested in your device. We would like to develop something together. Signed NDAs, and we started to cooperate. By August in 2017, we had the Max MSP official integration released. 2017 also was the year in which we made contacts with lots of companies. We were offered to buy out. We were offered to license the software. We were offered to do investments. All kinds of offers were done to us. Really interesting experience. We didn't want to buy. Not that the offer was not good, but we wanted to move ourselves. Didn't want to move to Asia, actually. In terms of technologies, one thing that became very apparent at that point is that the companies, musical companies, Ableton, Native, IKEA Multimedia, these companies have been pushing the development of an embedded system for a long time, and now the water is there. So all these companies are kind of desperate today to develop that. And our technology was ready. Actually, we have quite an amount of work being done on the back end in terms of build systems and our tool chain. And this is very interesting for these companies because they don't have this knowledge. These are all firmware-based companies or doing actually software for Windows and Mac. By 2018, the turn of the year, I finally managed to get the investment. After the experience that started in Sonar in 2015, by the end of 2017, I got a confirmation. We got a public/private investment, and we got 400,000 euros in an investment, which looks like a lot of money, but for a hardware company, it is not. Just to have an idea, Native closed an investment of 30 million just recently to do embedded devices as well. And first thing I did, hire a CEO. So this is Ronnie. It's our new CEO. Now I am the CPO. Our team here, as you can see, me, Crudo, Ale, this is Ale. We are the original members. Everybody here is new members. We've been changing members all the time since we came here for a number of reasons, and this is something I want to talk about a bit, about having a company and how, in the end, the company, it's just an aggregation of people. So if people leave, there is no company. And it's not about the code, it's not about the software, it's not about the device itself, it's about the people. And that's how we are here. Now, spoiler alert, I'll make some considerations here. I have some topics. And please, let's not get inflamed. So first of all, the many interactions with the Linux Audio community. Being an open source project, of course, we've since, especially after the announcement in the 2014 LAC, we had lots of different interactions with the Linux Audio members, ranging from pure goodwill help to actually contractor work, and some of them very good, some even bad. Some work that we had from Fonts, for example, we cannot stress how much we are grateful for helping with the audio interface. Harry was helping us pushing the company. We had the great Filippi working for us as a full-time team member. Lots of different experiences, and I really can't conclude nothing about that. I can bring some problems on some things, but overall, we are very grateful, and it's so awesome to have a community around you. Now, given that, this is a sentence that we listen a lot. It is difficult to make money with open source, and I hate this sentence because it's so misleading. It is difficult to make money, full stop, okay? When you say it is difficult to make money with open source, you give the impression that, oh, if I was not using open source, that would be easy, and that couldn't be more of a lie. Making money, it's not easy. And when I say making money, I don't say working by the hour. I say produce something, be it a service, be it a device, whatever, and convince someone somehow to take money out of the pocket and put in, and you know, buying that thing that you are selling. Really, guys, it's not easy. It's really not easy. The market is full, and if it was easy, everybody would be a millionaire. It's just not easy. First thing, once people are paying for something, the demands are so high. It's so high because people are paying for it. They want results. They want you know, they want quality. The demands are high. I'm even mentioned here Paul Davis' keynote from last year because he touched a lot on this point. But I can't stress enough how much, apart from your technology itself and what you actually do, polishing, testing and debugging, making sure that the things are working. Accessibility and ease of use. You want the users, they don't want to waste time with the product. They just want to sit and use it. And customer care. These are things that are boring. It's nice to open the way, but then to put the, you know, that's the boring part. And seriously, it's more than half of the work. It's not developing. I would never say that development it's easy, but it's exciting. And there are other parts that are not exciting, and you have to do them. There's no escape. Another thing that, and this is another very big misconception. I see this very angry discussions on the list on what is good, what is bad. And my take on this is products are solutions, but to whose problems? And that is the big question. A product can be good for a person and bad for another person because people have different problems, so they have different way of solving those problems. When we sometimes we come here and I talk to Linux people, and people have the impression that I'm pitching a product. And seriously, guys, Linux Audio users are not our target audience. Please, please, I'm not pitching a product. I talked this in 2014. I talked this in 2015. And I say again, there's a huge amount of people out there that are not tech savvy as everyone here is, and they want different solutions and they have different problems. And our idea is not to sell to you guys. Our idea is to sell to other people. And we want to get it's done here and try to commercialize this to the people who are not tech savvy to do that. Just in terms of numbers to understand, our highest, the peak of the Linux users in our customer base was in Kickstarter for sure. At that point, we got 26% of Linux users. Then we have 34% of Mac and 40% of Windows. And from then onwards, it's just downhill on the sense of Linux users. We are not selling to Linux guys. We are still selling to other people. And not meaning that we don't want to sell to you guys, of course. We would sell to everyone, but it's not our target audience. And being not the target audience defines a lot on how you market the product, how you approach the customers. Then comes the word marketing. That I know a lot of people hate marketing, but for me, marketing it's about translating. It's about explaining to other people what you are doing and why they could buy it because it could be a solution to your problem. We have in our forums, we have a lot of discussion around this, and it's impressive to see how much of a non-understanding of these different audiences there is. We had, I'll give one example. We have the plugins from the community, and there is a promotion process. So they can be on beta, and you can put those plugins on stable. When you put them on stable, what that means from a customer point of view is that you buy a module, you open the box, and that plugin is available with no opt-in. You have to make no choice, and that plugin is available for you. This is the face of our company. So this means that we have our marketing, et cetera. It's involved in that, because this is how we present to our customers. So I have a CMO, a marketing chief. I have people on the marketing studying and understanding and talking to people, and they are coming with solutions. And then we lay down some rules, some guidelines to how to promote plugins. So these are the community plugins, and we need you guys to do this and this and this and this so that these plugins can appear to everybody. This is our choice. Then we get things like, oh, no one cares about descriptions. Come on, guys. No one cares, meaning like someone might not care, but our marketing people, they care about those things. People are interested in this information. I know that for everybody who is tech savvy and experienced, that doesn't count. But for, again, our audience, it's not Linux Audio. For the big audience, they are interested and we want that. And this kind of clash in the community is very difficult. For me, it's such a political challenge to handle these things. This particular episode really hit us inside in the company. And you know, there's all this effort, let's do the release. And now the community itself kind of jinxed it. Last but not least, please stop the villainization. Guys, everybody needs to buy dinner, needs to pay the rent. It's all about the money. It's not, okay, please don't confuse me. I don't misunderstand me. I am against exploration. I am against racism. I am against misogyny. But everybody has to work to pay the rent. There's no escape. Seriously. I see a lot on the mailing list, and I don't even comment anymore about, oh, how the evil things about the commercial companies. And I don't see all of that. Seriously, guys. It's, I don't know. I think it's just too much. It's not easy to pull things off. Yeah, they cost money. And what we see in our experience is, first, the fact that we are Linux-based is not bringing us, I wouldn't say, any kind of preference in terms of work. The salary is still the thing. We are such a small company, we can't pay higher salaries, we lose employees to other bigger, non-Linux-friendly company. Period. That's it. It's all about the money in the end. We also, there's a thing about money and about this villainization that I think that people don't get, which is everybody's running risks. Everybody's willing to go under some risk. Some people more, some people less. Doing what I'm doing here, I am going through a huge risk undertaking. It's a lot of money. We've been bootstrapping. Our first real investment was this year. We were paying everything from our own pockets, and that's a huge risk undertaking. And it's okay. It's my own decision. What I have to talk about it is that we, for example, we offered shares of the company. To have an idea, we had about 100,000 euros in shares to distribute. We only managed, we barely reached the 20,000. Either for lack of interest, lack of commitment, lack of time, of continuing time staying with us. But the fact is that what we can give, we give. And it's a participation in the profits. And no, people are not willing to go under, to take the risks. And for me, this kind of ends up the discussion about the villainy thing. Because villains, in the end, are the people who are taking the risks. Last thing about considerations, we had two spin-offs. I don't know, rip-offs, spin-offs, doesn't matter. Zinchen, PySound. And for me, the villainization, actually, it's much more here than anywhere. I know that I know about complaints from the community here about how people misuse their code. Fons had some complaints about that. Other people had also about the misuse of the code. When that happens to your product and your hardware, it's much worse. It's much worse. So you put all this money, you spend rivers of money in design, development, etc., and someone gets your code, makes a new product, sells, and it's all good. I am the villain. Guys, seriously. It's not like that. And I'm done nagging here, okay? No more whining. And I would like to talk about the future. That's the cool part. And first of all, what we're doing here is about music. And music is the most popular art form. It's the most consumed one. It's the one that is the biggest amount of money. It's the art form that most people are either actually making or consuming. And musicians are not necessarily tech-savvy. Musicians have these, although some of them are really into digital music, they are not necessarily really into digital technologies in the sense that the computer is still scary for a lot of people. Talk about a terminal, whatever, it's totally out of the question. I consider myself quite tech savvy, and I see no difference between an iPad and a notebook. For me, it's all computers. For musicians, these are totally different beasts. Oh, the iPad, that's nice. iPad, tablets, computer, that's not nice. And so we have to understand this thing about the musicians if we're talking about products for musicians. I would like to give some insights about market. The music market, or the MI market, as they call it, everything related to playing, recording, and streaming, whatever thing about music, it's in this market, and we're talking about a $17 billion market a year. It's a big number, but it's not actually a big market. Other industries are 10 times bigger, but it's a considerable market. Just some information here, 43% of this market is in the US. Germany is the fourth country. This is the first year that China surpassed Japan. And the biggest selling products are still the fretted products, guitar, basses, etc. Pro audio comes right after. And what I find most interesting about this market is that it's so dynamic. Sectors from this market plummet and skyrocket from one year to the other. So here we can see variations from one year to the other. Portable keyboards and keyboard synthesizers are really going high. Acoustic pianos, organs, and instrument amplifiers are really going down. Instrument amplifiers, they actually ended up, at one point, they were falling 25% of sales each year. It's an industry that's dying. And there's this trend in electronic music about the machine, the push, and etc. All these DJ controllers. And this is really booming. And as we can see, DJ sales, DJ gear, keyboard synthesizers, effects, all this is really going up nowadays. So it's a very good moment for us, for our industry. And what I told back there, Linux Audio are not our target audience. We consider Linux Audio to be actually our potential partners. It's we doing things for them and not me doing things for you. It's a huge difference in that. And for me, it's important to stress that a lot because since I ever started using Linux, I really thought about Linux and using it for music purposes because of the full control of the machine and how you can custom configure your PC with Windows or even Mac. I never had that nearly that possibility. And now that everything is turning embedded, the Linux is getting more and more important on this sense because it is the technology that works. So Linux Audio, if we think about that industry, and I believe that everything that's growing there is going to run somehow Linux Audio or Linux Audio related stuff. And this is a huge potential for this community and the technology that was created for this community. You can see that companies, I think Ableton and Native are also sponsoring here because there is this growing interest in the Linux community because it's the solution. They have been pushing, but now they're catching up with that. And so, again, potential partners, not our target audience. What we did till now, in terms when I say potential partners, first thing we did, we just launched the plugin marketplace. So everyone here can make a plugin, sell in our marketplace, just like the App Store. Was released 2 weeks ago. It's going really well. The first batch of plugins is really nice, and the experience has been very nice. And but it's still very old school, on the sense that it's a marketplace. You do something, put here, I sell, get a fee. Nothing special with that in terms of actually business model. Now, where we can go to, and we are open to that, and again, it's the future. There are many elements in our ecosystem. We have the low-level developer, the guy doing drivers. We have the guy doing soldering. Then there is the guy who does the libraries and the elements of the OS. Then there is the framework developers, like LV2. And then there is the actual back-end software, then the front-end software, and we have the plugins. Plugins are like Lego pieces that you use to assemble the pedal boards, and these pedal boards are what we actually use. So lots of stakeholders in this chain. It's not the same person doing everything. And the customer, the person that it's actually consuming the product, it's the guy there on the very end. It's my profile. I am the dumb guitar player. I just get the guitar, I want to plug it in, sound comes out. That's what I want. This is the audience. Now, I'm paying for that. I'm buying a device. I am buying plugins. I might even buy pedal boards. We discovered, I didn't know that before I started, but pedal board making is an art. It's sound design. It's very high level sound design, but it's still like it's still sound design, and they have a monetary value. And I put these two words here, and I didn't write them entirely because I know that there is a lot of, you know, Bitcoin, blockchain, everybody. I know there's a lot of misuse in the market about that, and I don't care about Bitcoin, and I don't care about blockchain. What I care is that there is a technology that emerged that enables us to create some sort of ledging and some sort of flow of the money in the entire ecosystem, so that when a guy buys a pedalboard or buys a plugin, there is a bit of money that is going to everyone in that chain. Why is this so cool? If we go to the previous model, like the plugin marketplace or even the development as it is, the risk is a huge problem, because you have to decide whether you buy or not a technology, or if you hire someone to do that technology for you. And someone has to absorb that risk. And if the things don't work out in the future, you're done. If the things work out really well, you're very lucky, the money is all yours. With this B chain and the B coin, we would be able to license the things and make the things in a way that the risk is not so high for everyone, and everybody gets properly rewarded for what they did. Again, it's not about Bitcoin itself and blockchain itself, but the idea and the fact that there are technologies to do that. I'm not thinking about making an ICO or things like that. It's just about the technology. We are really interested in that, and I really foresee that to the future. Now, what about open source? What about community after all of that? Yeah, that's let's pause for suspense a bit. And our solution to that, actually, there's not an answer for it's going to be open source, it's not going to be open source, and what about the community, not community? There's not an answer. What we call our response to that is called Mod Labs. Now, Mod Labs, I'm announcing it right now. We don't have a Mod Labs yet. We are going to put that up, and it's an idea only on the moment. It's a concept. But we are kicking off, and just like I did other times at the LACs, I'm presenting for you guys firsthand, because you are the biggest stakeholders, in my opinion. Mod Labs is going to be an area of the company, and it's how, after all this story that we had, it's how we see ourselves responding and interacting with the community. It's kind of the interface layer. So Mod Labs will have an open part that this is really open, anonymous, just some guidelines, but no rules, and everybody do what you want. 500 spin-offs out of what was created there. Very good, very nice, no problems at all. Have no expectations. We don't have any demands for the people in Mod Lab. It's just pure open source community thing, anonymous. Just that we want to engage with the communities. I really would like to see more Zintian, but in a proper way. I would like to see more of the PySound. I would like to see more integration with other software. That would be awesome if we are using it or not in the business. I really don't care on this sense here. I want to see those things happening. We want to see the innovation. And we want to create interesting stories. And there's a closed part, which is this interface between the actual company, which is more guidelines, more rules. And as you approach the company, we suffered a lot with this lack of drawing the line of what is the company, what is not the company, what is open, what's not open. And Mod Labs is drawing that line. So identified only by invite or an application, and of course, under an NDA. I know that lots of people have shivers with NDA, but NDAs sometimes are necessary for a business. There's no way. And what we want to do with the closed part is to develop new products, bring new ideas to life. We want to test all those things. We want to have an organized testing community. And most importantly, we want to build a talent pool for Mod. This is going to be our way to bring people to what we're doing and maybe grow the company from there. It's a way to funnel these people to be part of the business with us. We want this to thrive. As Harry says, the future is a big place. I rephrase it. It's a big place, and it's very exciting. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you, Gianfranco, for the presentation. We have some time for questions now.
Please.
Gianfranco, wow, what a rough ride. Would you do it again?
Yes.
Okay, and that's quick.
Very good question. I would, and I would change only one thing. I would start thinking on marketing from day one.
Right.
From day one, seriously. Marketing, guys, it's not that, stop the vilification.
So that's my second question would be, maybe you want to talk about it, maybe not, your competitors. So who's that, Fractal Audio or more Guitar Rig, so Native Instruments?
It's difficult to say.
Right.
On a sense, we don't have like direct competition, on the sense that we have a very unique solution. But of course, we have competition. For those who prefer the PC-based solution, we compete with Guitar Rig and IQ Multimedia, the Amplitube, and this, all this market of plugins real-time. On the other hand, we compete with analog pedals, we compete with pedals, we compete with the multi-effect. So yeah, the it's all around. The thing is that we still have a very unique plugin product, Albert, very unique.
So it's basically the uniqueness of the mod rests on the modability.
I think it's the integration of everything into a
single box.
Yeah, right. It's the way that is integrated, the seamless integration, I think.
Yeah, but I mean the AX offers some, from Fractal Audio, offers some of the same things, but I don't think it's as open, so you can't just download your own plugins, as far as I know.
Yeah, this is what I say about the uniqueness. Some of the, if you go to the computer, you can get the sound and the installation, but then the form factor is not good for live. If you go for the pedals, you have the form factor, so we have all this checklist that everybody has part of it. That's the uniqueness. Question?
Hi. So is there like a plan for a more affordable version of the mod?
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
I can't disclose that, sorry. But we have something cooking that if turns out, it's a partnership, yeah. And if that turns out, we really will have amazing news. The thing about the pricing, that's a very good question actually, because at one point, or from one perspective, we are a community-based product. So the bigger the community, the bigger the value of the company, and the more the things happen. But on the other hand, the amount of engineering that we put inside the product, the costs of doing what we do are really high. We invested in the company until now about... With this investment now that we had, the 400K, we just surpassed the 1 million euros put into the company. The cost, and even then, we don't have scales and we don't have the expertise. It's so difficult doing hardware as cheap, like to get a Raspberry Pi for $35.
Yeah.
Seriously, it's not straightforward. It's really not straightforward, hence the partnership. We thought already about... doing smaller products that are cheaper. We have quality standards that we won't. We could rebrand maybe and have another brand to make crappier products. But mod, we have this quality standard that we won't. Simply we'll make no compromise. And the thing about the partnership that I said is that we already were thinking about a smaller unit that's cheaper. But with the partnership, we'll be able to go very cheap. Really very cheap.
Thank you.
The current solution is the Pi Sound for the chipsticks. by the way, about the Pi Sound, this is the thing about that I said that Linux audio users are not our target audience. If Linux audio users were our target audience, I would be doing the Pi Sound. I would not be doing what we do. Because I know that for a lot of people, it's enough. You know, but that's just a detour. Questions?
Thanks. So your tech stack, I believe, benefits a lot from open source technology. And I assume that in developing the tech stack, contributions are made to those projects in return. How does that fit into operations at Mod?
the actual code base, the contribution is not that high as you would think. The contribution comes in another way. Our biggest contributions, apart from, like I said, fonts helping us with the analog circuitry, which has nothing to do with the code base, what we have a lot is people working on plugins, for example, for free, just like enriching the ecosystem. Like Robin, he did amazing work for that. Ends up also doing a bit of collaboration in the code itself. But when we start and we release it, I was even being a bit naive, I thought that we would have more contribution, but we don't. And today I understand that very well, that actually you shouldn't. It's our own technology, you know about it, for people to come in, I don't know, unless it's born on a collective way for a collective use. We were discussing this yesterday, I was discussing with Crudo about exactly this, like what should be open source and what should not be open source? Do we have any kind of rule of thumb, kind of back end, yes, front end, no. And we got a lot of contribution and help, but not directly on the code base, I would say. You know, like a module I and mod host are our main softwares.
Maybe I wasn't clear. I guess I mean contributions from development at mod back into open source projects. In other words, you need to modify a code base.
Oh, okay. We developed drivers for a codec and put on the kernel stack. Yeah. Our software is open source, has been forked a lot, both the mod host as the module I. I believe the architecture of the module I was very, if some people didn't use it, they were at least inspired to actually do this remote thing. I think that Dave Robillard did for the Ingen, the REST API. As soon as we released the mod, Herman got the code and did a mod, like also HTML for Gitarix. So it's difficult to say. What we actually contributed on some other software was basically the kernel things. And some plugins that were not ours, and we found some bug and fixed for the person, also happens a lot. We also increased a lot existing plugins. There's a huge amount of interfaces and design work. So it's not code-based, but it's more or even so or more expensive than actually doing code, doing design and having proper interfaces.
Thank you.
I think just as a remark to that, that you really only miss the open source model when it's gone and you don't know where the bugs are coming from and who's going to fix it and when. So that, I think it's a competitive advantage also for your company, but also for, it's an advantage for the users of your products as well, even if they don't know how to read a single line of code. So that would be my remark about the open source approach to these things. I wouldn't want you to get rid of that.
There are two separate discussions. One thing is whether the code is open or not, and the other thing is how you license it. There's a lot of confusion on that. Yes, I agree that the code to be open is really nice. It's really positive. As you can see in our history, having open code, it's just how we pull it off. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here now. But there are some things about licensing, or maybe even about code, especially on the front end, that as a company, you have to defend yourself a bit, Albert. Otherwise, in the end, the bottom line for this is that you have to convince investors. You know, pockets are not infinite, so we need to convince people to put the money. And open source, you know, if you say, oh no, we don't have no control, there's nothing, then people say, okay, so what am I buying as an investor? This question gets very tricky, and it's not easy to convince and tell technology with the guys in the ties. Okay.
But you got hardware, so there's always this point there, which integrates into the software stuff, so...
Yes, hardware.
I mean, Apple can make a lot of money that way. So
yes, but this is the thing. It's only a protection, the hardware, when you're big. Because the hardware, although you don't have the design files, the hardware is there. It's open on the sense that it's not a compiled thing. It's You can buy a Duo, you can dismantle it and see everything. Okay, so you can reverse engineer hardware very easily. And and anyone with 10 times our size can make a cheaper hardware, just like he asked, do you have a cheaper one? Not yet. And I'm dying here to have the cheaper one, because I know that if I don't, someone will. You know, it's just a matter of time.
Hi, thanks for the talk. Can you say anything about like the Max MSP integration, like how?
Okay, I can tell. You want to know technical, or you want to know about the thing itself?
Yeah, I mean, Max MSP is not Linux compliant, or am I? So is there something wrong in my memory?
What do you mean?
No, so how just He wants to know how the integration works, because Max MSP, of course, doesn't run on Linux, but you don't need that.
Yeah. No. So the Max MSP is like Pure Data. It's the closed source version of Pure Data, whatever. And they some of their modules are the gen modules. They can be exported as C code, and we compile that code to us. It's simple as that. The thing about the integration is that what we did was, it's very seamless the way that we did it. So you have, if you have Max MSP, you are in your Mac or your Windows machine, you have Max MSP. You install an add-on, that's called the module package, one button, and the plugin is inside your Duo. It's basically that. This is the integration. But what it's doing is exporting code, compiling, and turning it into a LV2 plugin. Can I comment a bit about the Max MSP a bit more?
That's an interesting interface.
Okay. So first thing about the Max MSP is that actually we started doing a similar integration with Pure Data, with the PDLV2. This in 2014, I did my first attempt. Very buggy, very complicated. Lots of people from the Pure Data community know what we do, but never no one step it up to say, oh, let's do that. And on the other hand, the pragmatism of the commercial company, the guys from Max, they just got to us, signed the NDA, let's see the paper, let's do it. It's so much more straightforward. And it's not a complaint about, it's just this different mindset, how we pull it off. And I'm really willing to invest more on Pure Data. I just bought this book about the PDLib, because now with the commercial plugin store, lots of developers from iOS are actually using Pure Data in the PDLib. And that would be very nice. It's a totally different approach from what we do with the Max, because you have a Pure Data engine inside the Duo instead of actually compiling in native code. We already have the PDLib inside, but I would like a better integration for that, start investing more on that, because now with the commercial plugin store, the sound designers of Pure Data are interested.
Thanks again for the presentation, for your time. We now have 45. We now have a 45-minute break, and then we'll come back here in the main hall for a presentation regarding Ableton Link. In 15 minutes, there's a workshop in the seminar room, the one-hour challenge. So see you guys soon.